From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
If you have ever switched careers, if you've ever tried something new and then took it seriously and expected to be a success at it, then you have experienced this weird thing that happens, which is that other people don't really like this.
When you switch careers, there's this enormous societal resistance against it.
That is James Altucher, who, as you will hear more in a minute, has switched careers many, many times.
Like, people start telling you, you can't just do that. You can't just go from being an accountant to having a food truck where you make, you know, sushi burritos. Well, like, you can't do that.
Why are people offended by this idea?
I've thought about this a lot because every single time I've switched careers or switched passions, somebody or many people have said this to me.
And what are those switches? Oh, there are so many of them. I mean, you may know James Altucher. He is a pretty well-known personality in the entrepreneurship space. He has a very popular podcast called The James Altucher Show. His trademark, very large hair, impossible to miss. And I've had the pleasure of getting to know James for a few years now. But here's how he would explain his background.
I've switched careers quite a bit, both in good times and bad times. Like, I've built businesses, I've sold them. I've famously or infamously gone totally broke, depressed. I've had to bounce back. I was a computer programmer, and then I worked in the entertainment industry. Then I was an entrepreneur, and I started a business making websites. Then I was a venture capitalist, a hedge fund manager, a professional writer, a podcast. I've been an investor. I've started more companies, and I've been a stand-up comedian, and I treated that very professionally, not as a hobby.
So James has a lot to say about switching careers. He's done it quite a lot. He has a lot of insights on it. And very importantly, he has tactical advice on how to do it and how to think about it, not just as something you're dabbling in, but as a money-making enterprise. And James just wrote this book called Skip the Line, the 10,000 Experiments Rule and Other Surprising Advice for Reaching Your Goals. And when I saw that this book was coming out, I thought, well, this is something that so many people are grappling with, and particularly in the past year. And so I wanted to have him on the show to speak about it. And the conversation that I'm going to play for you is one where we really dive into what it means to make these kinds of changes. How do you do it? How do you think through it strategically? How do you become good fast at a new thing so that you can make money from it? These are all things that you really can do. James has lived it. So on this episode of Problem Solvers, it is James Altucher sharing his advice for how to skip the line. Coming up after the break. Did you know that health insurance doesn't always cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight? That is crazy! Even with comprehensive coverage, you can still get hit with substantial deductibles and copays. So, what is the solution? You can protect your family and your finances with an AirMed Care Network membership. As a member, if an emergency arises, the expense of air medical transport is completely covered when flown by an AMCN provider. Membership costs as little as $85 a year and covers your entire household every day, even when you're away from home. That is just pennies a day. I mean, look, this show is called Problem Solvers, so we all know that the unexpected can happen. An AMCN membership is protection no family should be without. For a limited time, as a Problem Solvers listener, you'll get up to a $50 e-gift card when you join. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/solve and use the offer code SOLVE. Again, that is airmedcarenetwork.com/solve and use the offer code SOLVE. All right, we're back. So on this episode, I am talking to James Altucher, man of many careers, author of the book Skip the Line, about how to do just that, how to make a big change and make it work. And to start, I want to pick up on something that had come up just a few minutes ago in the intro, which was we were talking about why people seem to hate when other people make big changes. Like, if you switch careers, if you try something new, you're going to get some negative feedback from people. And what's going on there? James had a lot of thoughts.
And I think there's several reasons. One is, A, they don't want me to change. They like who I am. They don't want they like the James who is a computer programmer. They don't want James who's making TV shows or whatever, or James who's a venture capitalist all of a sudden after being a computer programmer. Second, they don't want you to skip over where they are. So if they're a comedian who's been doing it for 20 years and you just walk in and go on stage, they feel a little threatened. Like, is this guy going to start touring around the world before I do? And the answer is going to be yes, but they try very hard to say, you know, you can't skip the line, James. Sure. We've all theater dudes. Yeah, it does feel unfair. And they get upset and they think they're acting out of concern for me. Like, don't move too fast or you'll get hurt. But, you know, you have to do open mics, or you have to start at a small hedge fund, then a bigger hedge fund. Then maybe you branch off and get an MBA and work at a bank. And then you start your own big hedge fund, whatever. And I think also there's, of course, there's a jealousy factor. Like, I remember when I was a programmer and I was looking into, I was working also with HBO about turning a website idea I had into a TV show. A lot of people very close to me were like, you got to watch out for the TV world. It's a very, you know, scary world. They didn't know anything about that. They were just like, didn't want me to do this. Yeah. And then also they really do think you can't do it. Like, there's just a sincerity. Like, they really do think you can't just do X, Y, or Z, whatever it is you're doing. You can't go from trading bonds at JP Morgan to being the top sports writer in the world or whatever, you know. And I, all these things I'm mentioning, by the way, are transformations I've seen in other people. So not only have I seen it in myself, but my thousands of podcast guests, all of them have at some point or other skipped the line. Like, take Richard Branson. This guy was a 27-year-old music magazine publisher. So when you think of that, you think, okay, maybe a little bit of a dirtbag somehow. Like, you know, right. Just kind of greasy and hangs out with musicians and whatever.
Played a type.
And then all of a sudden he's like, well, you know what? I want to start an airline in England. And which, by the way, there's only one other airline and it's a government-controlled monopoly. But I'm a 27-year-old music magazine publisher and everyone's telling me I can't do this and I'm going to do it. And then he was an amazing skip the liner, because then the next day, literally the next day, after he decides he's going to start an airline, he calls up Boeing and asks them to lend him a plane, a 747 preferably. And of course, they're like, who are you? You're like 27-year-old music magazine publisher going up against British Airways. Forget it. And he said, and he had amazing persuasion skills. And that's why I have a book about persuasion in Skip the Line, because this is a key part of skipping the line. And he basically said, listen, there's a government-run monopoly in England, so you have no pricing pressure. And Airbus is your competitor, and they're also in Europe. And good luck in the future. And they said, wait. Maybe we will lend you a plane. And he kept doing this. And Virgin Air was, you know, one of the, or Virgin Atlantic, whatever it was called, was one of the most successful airlines. It was recently sold for $3 or $4 billion to Alaska Air, and very successful.
Sure. And when I talked to Branson, I asked him, how did you build this business that kept going into new industries? Not what people usually do. People usually dig into one. You just kept expanding. And his answer to me was that every other company hires someone and asks them to stick to their onions. That was his phrase. I don't know if that's like a Britishism or if he just like said that, but whatever. He said, stick to their onions. And what he does is he hires people and then asks them to go find new opportunities and bring them to him, and he'll evaluate it. And I feel like that answer that he gave me and the story that you're just telling me now about the airline are both really about not having a fear of the unknown and the new. In both cases, he's bold and he's encouraging boldness and saying, just because you don't know something doesn't mean that you can't be really good at it. And I wonder if that's a key element of anybody who's been able to skip the line in the way that you're describing.
Yeah. And my point in the book is that anybody can do this. So there's a lot of research into how to be great at a skill. And again, remember, I'm talking in this book, I talk about skills and I talk about making money as opposed to one or the other. But right. There's a lot of research in, well, there's the 10,000 hour rule. You have to do something for 10,000 hours so you can be the best in the world at it. Or, you know, there's all sorts of books about meta learning. And I got really hampered by this 10,000 hour rule thing, to the point where I was like corresponding on a daily basis with Anders Ericsson, who's the professor who developed that rule. And again, remember, it says you need 10,000 hours of deliberate practice before you're the best in the world at something. So I had several insights. One is, you don't need to be the best in the world to make money at something. There's plenty of musicians who make a living at it. There's plenty of computer programmers who are not in the top 10 in the world who get rich from it. There are plenty of investors who are not Warren Buffett skill, but make wealth or a living from investing, and on and on. And I realized, okay, forget this 10,000 hour rule. It's stupid. I don't need to be in the top 10 in the world, but you need to be in the top 1% of what you're doing in order to monetize. That does seem to be a general rule of thumb, but to be in the top 1% is different from being in the top 10. If there's a billion people doing who are chefs or know how to cook, being in the top 1% of chefs is not, that means you have to be in the top 10 million. It's not as hard as people think. And I have like 20 chapters on the techniques for this. You do have to know how to go from nothing to being in the top 1%. And again, it's hard, but it's not 10,000 hours. It's not impossible, particularly if you understand the techniques involved. Then I realized I've switched passions a lot and I had to get in the top 1% starting from scratch. And so I kind of just pieced together not only my podcast guests, but myself every time I've switched careers or interests or passions or whatever. And then just to summarize the book, but then I also wanted to, I get obsessed with things. If I'm going to be good enough to be in the top 1% in the world at something, I want to make money at it. I want to make a living at it. I want to do it for my life.
So I love this. And also, I love the mind shift on the 10,000 hours thing, because that is something that's lodged in popular culture, thanks to Gladwell, I suppose. And yet, the truth of it is, you're right. You don't need to be. I mean, I think about myself. I'm not the best writer in the world. I think I'm a fine writer. I'm not the best in the world, but I make good money off of it. And it's because of, I guess, other things that I'm doing that I haven't really thought of. So I'm curious, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, you've got a wealth of information in the book, which we're not going to be able to cover all in here, but like, let's just talk about maybe like a technique or two that you found in your research that you also then discovered that you had done yourself. And then we can move on to how to make some money off of this stuff.
By the way, there was no research involved in this book. Everything, I specifically was anti-research. Okay. And the reason is, I read all these books, for instance, on, let's just say, take persuasion as a topic. The books say something like, okay, in the middle of a meeting, cross your legs. If they cross their legs 3 minutes later, then they'll do whatever you say, like you could persuade them. That works 57% of the time in our studies. Okay, that has never worked for me. Like that technique, which is quoted in every research or every book on persuasion, is bullshit. Like all this stuff, all this research-based stuff doesn't make any sense.
Sure. So, okay, well, let me redefine research. I didn't mean research in the social science sense. I meant more in the pattern matching sense. You're talking to tons of people and you're also talking to really smart people and you're trying to identify the patterns of success that they've had.
Right. So I'll give a couple. So one is I redefined the 10,000 hour rule as, let's call it the 10,000 experiment rule. And actually, I appreciate the editors and publishers wanted to keep the word 10,000, but it's really more like the 100 experiment rule. Basically, if you have the basic knowledge of whatever it is you're passionate about, now you can start to experiment. And what's an experiment? It's like you have a theory that you don't know and possibly all of society doesn't know it. And then you construct a really simple way to test your theory. And by simple, I mean it should be free or cheap. It should be very quick. It should be easy to set up. The downside should be minimal or zero, and the upside should be enormous. So like an example experiment was, you know, in Richard Branson's case, was calling Boeing and seeing if he could borrow a plane. It cost him nothing to do that. What was the downside? That some employee at Boeing would laugh at him later. And the upside was enormous. He'd actually get a plane. And if he failed, the downside also was he learned that either his persuasion technique wasn't working, or Boeing wasn't the right choice for him and he'd have to figure out another plane manufacturer, or he would just give up on this idea. There's probably many ideas he didn't pursue because the experiments didn't work out. So that's very important. So for instance, for me, when I was raising money for a hedge fund, I had to try different experiments. I would reach out to hedge fund managers and I would say, hey, can I meet with you? That experiment didn't work. I would say, hey, I'm a big fan of yours. I like this, this, this. That didn't work. But one time I did an experiment, I had written some software to model the stock market and it was working and I was trading it in with real money. And I would actually send the software to hedge fund managers and I would say, here's an audited track record of this software, like I'm using it and I'm happy and it seems to fit your style from what I hear of your style. And I'm happy to just give it to you. I'll even train your employees how to use it, but here's the guide on how to use it and you never have to respond to this. That experiment worked and I raised millions and millions of dollars because people saw that it worked. They were intrigued. They saw that it worked, but rather than train their employees, they just allocated money to me. And so,
did you? So I love that. And I have not heard that story from you before. What I'm curious about is how somebody knows to keep going. Oh, hi, now it's me talking to you, not me talking to James. Sorry to interrupt myself, but it felt like a good cliffhanger there because we will keep going with this episode. But first, we have to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Do you need to upgrade your business's Wi-Fi performance? Is your Wi-Fi slowing down when you work from home because you're sharing it with your family? Do you wish you had your own secure Wi-Fi network separate from the rest of the house? Netgear Business's Wi-Fi 6 products represent the latest in Wi-Fi technology. They deliver unmatched speed, coverage, security, and capacity for growing your business or working from home. They're also packed with features like the ability to create a separate network at home dedicated to your work. Plus, seamless management helps keep your guests and employees connected and your data protected, providing visibility from anywhere at any time. The world runs on Wi-Fi, and small businesses and home offices are no exception. With Netgear Business Solutions, you get the very best Wi-Fi performance to keep you connected whether you're in the office, working from home, or on the go. Visit netgear.com/business and use the code SOLVERS10 at checkout to save 10%. That is netgear.com/business with the code SOLVERS10 at checkout to save 10%. All right, we're back with the second half of my conversation with James Altucher. Now, remember, just before, James was talking about perseverance and how to keep going even though the first couple things that you try in a new arena are not going to work. And I wondered, well, okay, how do you know that it's worth continuing to try? Like, how do you know you're on the right path at all? Because here's the thing. A great idea is 10,000 experiments. Experiment, 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 experiment. But somebody is going to try that, and the first 78 experiments are not going to work, and they're going to wonder, am I on the path towards eventually figuring this out, or am I just knocking on the wrong door here and I'm never going to get in? You seem to have built into you some expectation that you would eventually figure the answer out. I'm curious what you think about where you're going through all the no's.
So, okay, so this moves over from skills to monetization. So for instance, let's say invest. So I have a chapter in the book called The Spoken Wheel Approach. So let's say what it means is investing is the wheel, but there are many spokes. I wasn't tied to one outcome. Like, so one spoke is starting a hedge fund. Another spoke might be being a stockbroker. I didn't want to do that, but it's worthwhile listing all the spokes. Another is day trading. Another is writing an investment newsletter, creating an investment course, working for a hedge fund, working for a bank. So you create all the spokes. So for instance, one guy I know, you probably know him as well. He traded bonds at JP Morgan, but his real passion was sports. And during the pandemic, he had some free time and the economic lockdowns. And he started a newsletter. One of the spokes is to be a professional athlete. He couldn't do that. Another spoke is to be a sports manager or do a podcast about sports, whatever. But he knew he had a specialty. He had a passion for sports, and he had a very big specialty in finance. He had been trading bonds for 20 years and he was bored of it, but he loved sports. So he started a newsletter on Substack.com writing about all interesting sports stories related to finance. So for instance, he had one issue about how to value a basketball team. Another issue was, why did the guy who did the Super Bowl halftime not only not take any money for performing at halftime, but he actually used $7 million of his own money to produce his show? And it turned out Beyonce and Maroon 5 did similar things in prior Super Bowls. So he broke down the economics of the Super Bowl halftime. So I'm not interested in sports at all. I devoured these stories. I love them. So I called him up and he said, yeah, I started this newsletter 8 months ago to pursue this passion I had in sports. And now I have 27,000 subscribers. I quit my job at JP Morgan. And he's going to do that for the rest of his life, this passionate thing. And his experiment was, what if I intersect my two passions? Turns out he's the best in the world at the intersection of those two passions. And then in terms of spokes, it's not like he advised financial professionals on sports transactions. That was one spoke. He decided to take the newsletter approach because it was a little easier. He writes 5 newsletters a week and boom, has a career. Maybe he experimented with other spokes, but it didn't work. So that's an example of one way to skip the line is to intersect two different fields and be among the best in the world at the intersection. So for instance, I know this comedian who's 27 years old, very difficult when you're 27 years old to get stage time at every comedy club on the planet. But if he just walks into any comedy club, they will give him stage time. Why? Because ever since he was a little kid, for fun, he would freestyle rap. And here's this kind of pasty looking British kid who, if you give him five random words, within seconds, he will construct the most insanely intelligent, funny, creative rap and just keep rapping with those five words. And that combined with comedy, because he makes them funny, that's his act. And he's amazing at it. It's like a magic trick. And that's an amazing thing. So that's one type of, I call this in the book, possibility sex, which is similar to something I've written about before called idea sex. But look at all your possibilities in front of you, see how you can intersect them, and you might be the best in the world at the intersection. There's one other important concept. I mean, there's a lot of things from the book, but I want to mention, like you said earlier, you may not be the best writer, but you may be. But here's the interesting thing that I've noticed, and this is all throughout history. I don't know if when you were a kid this was happening, but Betamax and VHS were competing to be the, you know, VHS was a tape. You'd put in a video recorder and you'd watch a movie.
I'm old enough for that.
Yeah. And Betamax had a better technology. It was like higher quality video, higher quality audio. And yet Betamax lost. VHS dominated. Betamax disappeared almost instantly.
And then it happened again with DVD and Blu-ray.
DVD and Blu-ray. And by the way, it might even have happened in many iterations of different phones and so on. But the interesting thing is, I can't tell, most people cannot tell the difference between one writer and another writer. Like, oh, this writer's 37% better than this other writer. Most people can't tell. The average person on the ground, so to speak, cannot, maybe the writers can tell, but the average reader can't tell. I mean, E.L. James with 50 Shades of Grey sold 100 million copies of her book, more than Ernest Hemingway sold with all his books combined. So I noticed this once. I was in the back of a cab and I was just casually talking to the cab driver and he said, oh, he plays chess. And I thought, oh, that's cute. He plays his game and he's probably okay at it. And I said, oh, I play as well. And he's like, yeah, yeah, I'm the Turkish national champion. I just won it last year and then I moved to the US. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what's your ranking? And now I'm a strong chess master. He dwarfed me. And like, he would be able to beat me, let's say, 2 out of 3 times if we were to play a match. But nobody cares. And if you watched his game, if you were an amateur chess player and you watched his games and you watched my games, you would not be able to tell who is better. So that's why I say you only have to be in the top 1%. No one could tell the difference between even Warren Buffett and any other investor who happens to be in the top 1%. It's just a
yeah,
lot.
I love that. That's a really wonderful point that you make. And I wonder, you know, you brought that up after talking about some of the monetization stuff. And I wonder if I have a correct connection here, which is you think it's important for people to remember that because if you're going to think about how to monetize something, you don't want to limit yourself. You want to free yourself from limiting thoughts and assumptions. And
yes,
if I set out to be a writer, but I looked at who are considered to be quote unquote the best writers, and I said, well, I'm not as good as those people, then I might not have ever even tried to make money as a writer. But because I didn't care about that, I mean, I cared about it a little bit, but clearly not enough to hold me back, I was able to put my writing out into the marketplace, test it, figure out where I best was, and move through a career in which, I mean, I started out not making a lot of money. My first job paid me $20,000 a year, but I eventually got to a place where I was making pretty good money as a writer. And that wouldn't have happened if I felt like the marketplace would only welcome the absolute best, and I didn't think of myself as the absolute best. Is that a fair way of reading what you were just saying?
Yeah, and you know, it also opens you up for more possibilities. Like if your only outcome is to be the best writer in the world, that really might take you 10,000 hours and you still might not be the writer who monetizes the most. But if you're a pretty good writer, or if you're even a decent enough writer, you know how to write a book and nothing else, and you happen to have an idea about a girl who is shy but falls for a billionaire, you might write 50 Shades of Grey. But if you wait until like, well, I'm not good enough yet, it might not work. Or let's say you play tennis. Okay, you're never going to be the top tennis player in the world, or I never will be, but maybe I'll get good enough that I can then know what to ask when I interview the top tennis players in the world. And maybe I write a book, Think Like a Tennis Player, or The Inner Game of Tennis, which is a very popular book from the 70s. And it sells 10 million copies and makes me wealthy. And then I decide to do the same thing for basketball or something else. So you open yourself up to more possibilities if you're generous with yourself about how good you need to be. And again, being in the top 1% is not easy either, but it's a lot less stress than being the top 10 in the world. And I'll give you a weird example, but like I'll give chess again. There are many chess players who are clearly not even in the top 10,000 in the world, but they stream on Twitch and they have their particular style of streaming and they're funny or they're interesting or they have a different way of looking at the game. And they may have more followers than the world champion and they make $1 million a year. So again, they combined some other ways that they've worked on their personality or their performing skills. And they also are in the top 1% of chess, which is not very good in a lot of measurements, depending on who you're comparing yourself to. But they make a great living, better living than professional chess players. So you asked for techniques. I just want to mention, like, experiments is a very valuable technique. There's a lot of examples in the book. I describe experiments, insane experiments I've done. But another important one is understanding what the micro skills of your skill is. And, you know, you're the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. It's a great test case because there is no such skill as entrepreneurship. No one can really say, I'm a good entrepreneur. I have a good entrepreneur skill. Really what it is, it's a basket of smaller skills, like coming up with ideas, executing on ideas, sales, marketing, negotiation, management, leadership, which is different. And so you have to get good at some subset of those skills. And it helps. Why does it help to understand that? Because people, when they're trying to get good at a skill, sometimes they go all over the place. They don't know what to study. They don't know how to train themselves. And it helps to label things as very distinct micro skills. And then you could develop ways. Maybe you need to work on your tennis. Maybe you need to work on your forehand, but not your backhand. Or maybe you need to work on your serve. But if you just in general try to work at tennis, you're probably not going to get good fast. Mm. And then I have a bunch of other things too. I have like the plus minus equal, you know, get a coach, find equals. Also, you don't really understand something if you can't explain it. So find people to teach. That's extremely, extremely valuable. Whenever I want to get good at something, the first thing I do, find a mentor or at least a virtual mentor, find equals who will challenge me and we're all rising up together, and find someone to teach. And that sometimes happens through writing. Sometimes it's direct, because if you can't explain something simply, you don't understand it. And the most valuable thing is the minus, actually. Like, teaching is the best way to learn the fundamentals of any skill. And then, so I have a bunch of techniques like that. And then I have a bunch of techniques like the spoken wheel approach, or two steps backward, three steps forward. I have a whole chapter on frame control, which is a kind of a way of looking at persuasion, that in high stakes situation, one person and only one person has the frame. And so it's very valuable for persuasion in high stakes situations, like negotiating a raise, for instance. And so again, I have distinct chapters, but they're related: how to get good and how to make money.
Mm. James, I love this. Let me ask you kind of a concluding philosophical thing here, which is, you are describing strategies for jumping into something, right? Functionally speaking, right? For being able to get into something that you don't have a deep background on and figure out, you know, in fairly short order, how to make it work, or how to make some version of it work, how to adjust yourself to the needs of whatever marketplace you're going in. Do you think this has been your career path? And to a degree, it's been mine, though not in the same as yours. Do you think that, is this the way people should think? I don't even know how to ask you.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, is this a better strategy, do you think, than trying to drill in for your whole career in one spot? We have a world of opportunity available to us. We have tactics and skills that enable us to move around and pursue new passions. Do you think that this is just a more logical way of going about your career, letting go of the idea that you have to just drill in for one thing for your entire career, and instead finding what works for you at whatever moment you're in?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's fine if you want to, like Warren Buffett does one thing his whole career for 70 years. He's been an investor and he's the best in the world. And there's no doubt in anyone's mind, the guy is the best in the world. And so that's good too. And that was his passion. He never switched passions. But to be fair, he did switch passions a little bit. He became an excellent bridge player. He plays bridge every single day, most of the day. And he did a lot of these techniques that I mentioned. He got a plus minus equal. Bill Gates was one of his equals. They became bridge partners for many years. But for me, let's say I go from being an entrepreneur to being a stand-up comedian, that's a radical change. And it happens because my passions change. And so I had to experiment to get good. I would do comedy, for instance, on subway cars, because it's hard to get stage time when you're just starting, but I can always go on a subway and there's a hostile audience ready to tear me apart.
So it's very challenging hostile.
And it's very scary. So you have to, it teaches you to overcome fears too, some of these experiments and some of these techniques. Or sometimes you can say, well, I loved something as a child. Can I get back into it and do it professionally as an adult? So sometimes, and you know, you said, is this a way for people to think? The problem we have right now is 55 million people last year at some point or other filed for unemployment. Like, sometimes we don't have a choice. Mm. And then when you don't have a choice, you say to yourself, well, do I do something just to make some money? Or is there a way I can do something I love And everybody will say, no, you can't do that. People have been doing it forever. You can't just start and do that. You better just work at a warehouse or whatever. But I've been broke, and from being broke and switching passions and interests, I've started from scratch and done this approach, as have the hundreds of people on my podcast, with maybe rare exception for people who just did one thing the whole time. And I see a lot of people who did one thing and got great at it, and now they're switching. Like, let's take Danica Patrick, you know, was a race car driver since she was a kid, and then she was a great race car driver, but now she's doing other things in her life, and she switched passions, she switched interests, she's doing more charitable things, and so on. Elon Musk was a programmer, and now he's a rocket scientist. So, you know, now you could argue he had the money to do it, but yes, but other people have done it without having the money, me being an example. I'll give you one quick example, though, is start just a few months ago, again, just to test, in part, just to experiment again with the ideas in this book. So I mentioned earlier, I was a chess master. Now, that was a long time ago. I was a kid. So when you don't study something for 30 years, you lose essentially all your skills. And I've been able to see that in practice. I lost all my skills. So I decided I'm going to use just the techniques in this book, and I'm going to get as good as I was once before. And not only that, I'm going to get better. So I found a plus minus equal right away. I set up a training program for myself with learning the micro skills. I did the idea calculus in the book. I did experiments. And at this point, 3 months later, or 3.5 months later, probably a little bit better than I was at my very peak 30 years ago.
Wow.
And I've only done the techniques in this book and nothing else. I mean, wouldn't really be that many other things to do, but it worked. And I did it in a focused way, applying these techniques and saying, I want to be back in the top 1%. And because chess is statistically modeled, I can see actually on the chess.com, which has 62 million people, I'm in the top 0.01%. Whereas when I started a few months ago, I was probably in the top 20%. So it makes a difference.
Well, you're going to have to go track down that guy from the taxi cab and challenge him to a match.
I know, I was thinking that, but unfortunately, I won't be able to track him down. But yeah.
Well, James, always a pleasure speaking to you. The book is called Skip the Line, Ingenious Simple Strategies to Propel Yourself to Wealth, Success, and Happiness. And people can find the book and you where?
Anywhere you find books. If there's a bookstore open, I encourage going to the bookstore, but Amazon.com or BN.com, it's available. And I really hope I never really try to like push a book I write. It feels weird, but I really think this is my best book, like, because it's the book I have with the most practical advice, but still has the storytelling in it. And I really just love this book, and it's saved the ideas in it have saved my life over and over again.
So there it is. Thanks again to James Altucher. Definitely go check out his book. And if you have been thinking about making a change, I hope that after this, you feel more empowered to do so.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.